We've spent a lot of time on this podcast discussing the policy side of economic growth and attracting investment. But what is it like to sit on the other side of the table, across from senior policymakers, as a representative of large private sector players? What are you actually looking for from government? How do you decide where to invest? And once a decision has been made, what actually goes into setting up operations from scratch in an entirely new setting? Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and my guest today is Bill McCraith, who is an honorary professor at Glasgow Caledonian University and has spent his career building apparel supply chains across the world, working on both the manufacturing and the retail side. Bill, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Oliver, thank you for the invitation.
So I was wondering if we could go back to the start of your career, which was in the United Kingdom. What did supply chains look like back then when you were supplying Marks and Spencers?
Yeah, it's an interesting view, and it's actually a view of what the future might look more like. And so let's go back to the late 70s, 80s, when I was, I'm kind of a garment engineer, industrial engineer by training, in the apparel industry, exclusively within the UK, and at least in my career, primarily supplying Marks and Spencers from factories, initially out of Scotland, and then longer term out of England. The first thing you have to recognize is that everything was self-contained, right? So if it was sold in the UK back then, and this is not just for apparel, but if it was sold in the UK, it was most probably fully vertically made in the UK, right? Probably with a few exceptions or some exceptions, and that is the commodity, the raw material, the very original raw material. And if you think about it, everything really starts, at least did start back then, from three source points, right? It was drilled out the ground, it was mined out the ground, or it was grown. Everything came out the ground. That was the three sources. And a lot of that would have been imported. In the case of apparel back then, it would have been primarily cotton. But from that point forward, everything was done within the UK, right? So think about it. The furthest apart these things are 600 miles at best. Marks and Spencer's head office is in London, as were many of the large retailers, working in the same time zone, speaking the same language, under the same rules and legislations, and all the people who were making the product were also buying the product. So the producers were also the consumers, and it was relatively closed loop. And it was fast. At least the manufacturing part of it was fast. Again, in my environment, we would typically receive an order from Marks and Spencers over the weekend. So on Monday, we would look at that order from Marks and Spencers, and we would be shipping that order to Marks and Spencers by the Friday, right? Now, we'd have forward projections from Marks and Spencers that allowed us to hold some finished goods inventory, of which we just continually replaced on a continuous cycle. But the whole supply chain was incredibly fast, incredibly connected. And again, no one was staying up late to have late night calls with China. No one was struggling with interpreters at that point. We had our problems. We absolutely had our problems. But looking backwards, it was a very nice environment to work within. Again, legislation applied to everyone. Even the product development was a relatively fast cycle back then, because designers could fly to the headquarters of the manufacturers to design and develop product and be home that evening to spend their evening at home and not have to spend a week overseas someplace. So the whole thing was very closed loop. We had no big carbon footprints on logistics. Transit times were non-existent, virtually non-existent. Waste was minimal because you only made what the consumer bought. It was nice to look back, albeit at the time we had our problems.
And when did you realize that that old local model was starting to break?
So if you look in the, I would say if you look from the mid 80s onward, what you saw was a number of, I would say maybe lower cost retailers had started to push out their manufacturing further afield. And further afield at that time was Portugal, potentially Egypt, Morocco became a large manufacturing, apparel manufacturing facility. So it started back then, probably at the same time people like Marks and Spencer's had banners on their walls, made in Britain, not unsimilar to the US, made in America. A lot of the big retailers had, really believing that, you know, somehow the consumer would vote for it being made in their environment as opposed to made someplace else. And so you started to see this, what was relatively slow and unusual shift offshore, with a lot of naysayers out there, a lot of people who just fundamentally believed that apparel, the UK consumer would not buy the quality that people perceived would come from foreign locations, and it just would never happen. So you saw the front edge of that, and then you started to feel the price pressure that was creating, where the prices of those people that had moved away were significantly lower than the prices of the retailers that were staying at home. And I think that was the point at which, certainly in my case, there was just this realization that that move was inevitable, and that would be the late 80s, that ultimately led to my move away from the UK to build manufacturing overseas. But you typically saw right at the end of that a huge focus in the UK of how do you improve efficiencies, how do you remove labor content from the work, to try and compete with offshore. And so you had this frenzy, this last minute frenzy of trying to hold on to that work. Not actually that different to what you see in China today. So you actually see a very similar move in China today on something like that, as they attempt, as the last manufacturers there attempt to hang on to the apparel industry, which inevitably the majority will move away. Not all, because China itself is a huge consumer market. But that was really what drove it, that initial shift. And then it was just very clear that the whole thing, the whole manufacturing, not just in the UK, but across Europe and the US, would eventually just collapse inward, starting with apparel and then eventually across most industry sectors.
And you hinted at it there, but then after working in the UK, you made the decision to move to Panyu, China. I was wondering if you could talk us through that, what you were seeing when you arrived and what you were tasked with when you found yourself in this new setting.
Yeah, so my task was actually relatively simple. I had done some fairly interesting work in a large manufacturer in the UK. At that point, I think I was only 28 years old, but I had done some very interesting work, really off the back of some work I had seen done at Levi's at the time, that significantly improved the quality of that manufacturing, those manufacturing locations. As a result, the request was go build first world manufacturing in a third world country. Now, you can debate whether China was or wasn't a third world country, whether that term is right or not. That were the words that were being used at the time. And so for me, it just felt like, one, it was inevitable what was happening in the UK, although, again, I don't think a lot of people saw that. And two, I saw it as an adventure. I saw it as a way to go out and actually do things that I probably would never get the chance to do. And so here I am, August 1990, I think it was. I turn up in Hong Kong and then get on a ferry to go up to Panyu, China from Hong Kong into a place where there were barely any paved roads at that time. I think I drove in the one taxi in the whole province that existed at the time, along dirt track roads through paddy fields, which had to have lasted a good hour and a half, to get to this location where, again, the ask was, okay, do what you've done in the UK and do it here. And I had a small factory that I was asked to really turn around and turn it into something that was capable of supplying the UK. There was just so many things that were different, especially for me, right? So think about, I had grown up in a place and entered an industry that was already over 100 years old in the UK, right? So I was surrounded by trained mechanic, trained line supervisors, trained production people, trained technicians. And my only job in the UK was to orchestrate them in a way that made us better than anybody else. In China, I had to go right back to the beginning. There were no trained mechanics, or very few, right? There were very few kind of textile engineers. There were no textiles in China. And that is something that today, anyone I talk to in the industry who's under the age of 46 would believe that everything was always available in China, right? It's the core. Everything was always there. When I went there, there was nothing. Everything was imported. Materials were imported from all over the world, Korea, South Korea, Japan, lace from France, fabric still from the UK and the US. Certainly every design innovation was coming from those places. There was nothing. All of that had to be built and created. There were no work study engineers, no line managers that were capable of running modern production lines out there. So for me, there was literally a five-year period of building all of that stuff up, training people. And again, I think one of the biggest, maybe it was a year in, but I was really struggling to get the quality right. And again, I'm doing everything through interpreters and a few graduates around me who spoke English. This realization that in the UK, the consumer was the producer. So the people actually sewing the goods in the UK knew what quality they were willing to accept, and that was kind of built into what they made. That was not the case in China, right? The quality levels there were acceptable for China at that time. They were unacceptable for the UK. And so there was this big challenge of, how do you get people who have never been to the UK, never been to Europe or the US, to suddenly understand the quality requirements and why we're driving these things, where in many cases at that time, in their eyes, that was perfectly acceptable. And they didn't understand why there was such a big push to improve quality. So there was just a host of challenges that literally, I would say, took us 5 years of hard work to just get the baselines in place to a UK level before we were able to then refine beyond that point. And that really came off the back of, over time, I hired about 35 expats out of the UK and brought them in to set up training schools, etc., on all the different disciplines that were required. But it was just a lot of challenges as I went in there. Stuff that I never expected to have to deal with. 3-hour lunch break was just a thing that you and I would say, that doesn't make sense. Why would anyone have a 3-hour lunch break? And that was standard in South China at that time, because the workers had a responsibility to go home, make lunch for their others, have lunch, and then have a sleep to allow the digestive system to get in. And so trying to persuade people who had grown up with a 3-hour middle of the day break in what was historically an agrarian society, that no, 30 minutes is going to be the standard break, that was huge. And I lost a lot of people through that process who just were unwilling to accept these changes. And even moving from a basic wage over into an incentive scheme that we implemented to match the incentive schemes in the UK, that resulted in a mass walkout in my first production facility. I think it was the first mass walkout in Panyu of workers. And they just didn't accept this idea of, moving from a base salary each week to work getting a base salary plus an incentive. And I, again, part of my learning there was the value of great interpreters, because the message hadn't gotten through. People had been very polite in the interpretations, and I needed people to be very specific. So there was just a whole bunch of stuff that I had to deal with that, again, was outside of anything I had ever had to deal with. However, it set me then up perfectly for every other country that I had to deal with out there as I rolled into multiple different countries. Every one of them had the same challenges. I would say one of the, and this comes off the back of an event that actually you and I were at recently, where someone in one of the sessions that I was talking in, an academic, asked me the question that in the work I had done in Ethiopia, they had read or heard that labor turnover was a huge issue for us. My response to him is, it was, but China was even worse, right? The labor turnover in the first few years in China dwarfed anything that I ever dealt with from that point forward. But again, if you come and look at China today, most people have no memory or no recollection that of the work that had to be done by the first movers that went in there.
That's always so interesting, and we'll get into your work in some other countries later on in the episode. I guess to pick up on some things you said there, so I guess people in terms of training, turnover, or all the various kind of aspects seem to be one of the big challenges you faced when you arrived in China. I was wondering a bit about if there were any other challenges and whether it was on you to solve them, or whether you could rely on the company to help you out, or if the government played like a particularly active role. You can imagine that things like infrastructure that are not something in your control but could still be make or break for a new factory in this setting. So yeah, any thoughts or reflections on the how the other players were also involved in trying to facilitate a successful factory?
Yeah, so a big question, right? I would start at a very high level and say, as we ran into challenges that they weren't policy challenges, because I one of the things again that I reflect on is China had very little policy at that time, right? It's not as if China had figured out the policy by the end of 1980 or 1980s, and I came in and there was simply all this policy set up to work within. If anything, in China, the reason China was so successful is there was a lack of policy. And I don't mean that in a negative term. What I mean by that is policy didn't get in the way of establishing industry. It was not restrictive, nor was it that enabling. It wasn't as if it gave these great tax kind of, you know, these tax-free years, etc. You just came in and you did business. Now, clearly you had to do business properly. But what I admired so much about China is that whenever I had challenges, either customs challenges, clearance challenges, way back then, everything basically coming out of China had to go through the border and into Hong Kong, right? Through that part, that southern part of China. That is not the case today. Most things leave China from the big ports. But back then, everything had to go through. And so at certain times of the month, typically the end of the month or typically the end of the year, the backup of transportation of people trying to get their goods out through the port, through the borders there, were horrific. And I have never worked with any government, and I'm talking local government, not kind of the China, think of it as the China federal government, but the local government people, typically the heads of the Communist Party at that time. I've never worked with a group of people who were more willing to help us solve those problems. And I don't mean that in a corrupt manner. I just mean that they were focused on making business successful. And so they often helped us clear the way where there was no policy. There weren't things in place that decided one way or the other. Even simple things like, again, I spoke about dirt track roads that I arrived in. And obviously that changed rapidly over time as industry moved in. But I had a challenge where I had no road between the main road and my own factory. And so my trucks literally had to go along these terrible potholed kind of road. But I reached out to the government and they got it solved, right? And again, I have never, probably the only other government, there was only one other government that I worked with that was as willing to help industry grow. And so you typically had industry go first, and then you had policy getting built almost just slightly behind it. And that seemed to be a perfect combination. Again, I just reflect today, I worry that too many countries are trying to get their policies right and look at how China is today and say we should have policies like that, when in fact, that's not how China grew. China grew without the policies, but very closely fitting behind the growth of industries. So that meant a lot of the onus kind of fell back to us, right? It was really up to us to kind of determine how we wanted to operate. Government, incredibly helpful. Local government, incredibly helpful. A lot of what was dictated about who you worked in China was not by China itself, but it was by the countries you were shipping to and where you meeting their requirements and how did you meet their requirements. And there was a lot of challenges within that. So again, I just give you an example. Many countries or companies like brands would have rules around the amount of overtime people could work, right? And again, this idea of working people excessively, how terrible that is. And it is, right? I'm not defending it, but working people excessive hours, etc. Where in China, as in many of the countries we went to, there was either no clear legislation around that, about the hours that people could work, or it was incredibly draconian. And there were countries I operated in that basically didn't allow any overtime at all, or maybe 2 or 3 hours a month of overtime. That's what was in it. The reality is it had never been applied, right? It was kind of legislation buried deep in the books. No one applied it. And so it was almost lost, I would say. Except now you're an international company, you come in, you have a requirement to operate by the legislation. And so suddenly you've got to get that legislation stripped out, rewritten, and re-implemented to meet the more norms of operating on a global platform. But here you are where you've got companies telling you can only work certain number of hours. And you're faced with that in a challenge where you have got operators in China, the vast majority of whom have left their homes some 2,000 miles away in northern China to come to southern China to work. And these are typically young people. They're in dormitories, right? Not exactly the greatest place to spend your free time. They're sitting in dormitories. They're away from their homes for a year at a time, typically going back at Chinese New Year. And again, I'm exaggerating to make a point, but they want to work as much as they can to make as much money as they can, because the sooner they can make whatever the target is that they've got in their head, they're done. It's game over for the South. And so you're under this pressure on one hand of don't work excess hours. On the other hand, you're under pressure from a lot of the operators from they want to work more hours because they don't want to be sitting in a boring dormitory. They want to make as much money as they can. And, you know, and we found that. We found that our labor, one of our biggest challenges on labor turnover is once people had worked in the South for 2 years, they didn't come back. And so you almost had this huge disappearance of labor. And you kept your fingers crossed after Chinese New Year just to see how many people returned, because they had often made more money in the time they had worked with you in the South than their parents would make in a decade in the north. And so, and again, I'm going back to an old time. It doesn't exist anymore out there. But government's incredibly helpful, trying to operate within the boundaries of the countries you're supplying and the brands that you're supplying, the retailers that you are supplying. And really, most of the onus is on the company and ourselves to make sure that we figure out then what is the right way, what is the right and best way to operate here.
After China, you moved from the manufacturing side to the retail side of the apparel industry. I guess that moves you one step closer to the consumer. And I was wondering if you could talk through what some of the key changes are from working on the manufacturing side to working on the retail side.
I just want to clarify the China thing, right? So where a lot of my initial work in the 90s was in China, that really expanded across greater Asia, Indian subcontinent. I built factories in Sri Lanka. We moved into Vietnam. We had operations in the Philippines. We were now operating across that whole region. And again, China was a great learning because it set us up to understand exactly then what we had to do everywhere else we went. And we were no longer surprised by what we ran into. It was our expectation. So now talk about that transition from the manufacturing side to the retail side. So, you know, I always use the term that it was in 1990, it was kind of 1999, I would say, is when I really moved on to the retail side. I moved to the US first as head of supply for a company called Warnaco, who were operating across Central America, still had some cutting facilities in the US and were expanding globally. But I was still very much on the manufacturing production side of the equation. And then in 1999, I moved to Victoria's Secret as the head of supply chain for Victoria's Secret and then eventually chief supply chain officer for L Brands on all their intimate product. So the challenge on that move was, here I am, I'm a supplier who, quite frankly, perceives the retailers and brands as the dark side of the equation, right? You have what's called this false hierarchy where, if I'm the brand, if I'm the buyer, if I'm the retailer, I'm somehow far more important than you are. And every time I need something, I'm going to ask you to partner with me on it. But every time you, the manufacturer, need something, yeah, that's your problem to deal with. And it was heavily biased in everything we did. And every time the retailer had a problem, they tried to blame me for it on the product, even though some of the issues had stemmed from them. So I really had this perception that they were not great players. Anyway, so that was my view. Now I turn up at Victoria's Secret stores and I'm now head of supply chain. And I remember very early on that someone fairly senior came up to me and said, "Bill, I'm glad you're on board. You'll now be able to sort out the suppliers out there." My response to that was, "I'm not here to sort out the suppliers. I'm here to sort out you. You are the problem, and you do not understand the impact you're inflicting upon yourself." Right? So I'm not here to sort you out for the supplier. I'm here to sort you out for you on it. What I quickly learned through that was that retailers and brands have a lot of challenges, right? You've got fickle customers, they're surrounded by a set of competitors that are trying to outflank, outmaneuver them, and they're trying to make the best decisions that they can on what is now incredibly long supply chains, right? Incredibly long supply chains. So no longer do you have the UK model that I described at the beginning. That has been completely destroyed, this closed loop. Everything is basically taking vast amounts of time to make decisions, to process, to make product, to ship it. And there are all sorts of challenges appearing out there. Excessive product is being made. Markdowns are rocketing kind of sub 10% when everything was made in the UK to now over 30% now that everything is getting made offshore. So there's massive distortion that's causing waste in the world, polluting the world. Whole bunch of issues that everyone is dealing with out there. And back then, it all worked and again, this is what makes the world very different today. Back then, the labor differential between the UK and China was 50x, right? So it was the labor cost in China was 50 times lower, 50x cheaper than it was in the UK back then. So people could accept long timelines. They could accept waste going up because the cost differential was just so massive that they were willing to do that. As you're well aware, that has now completely gone, and the cost differential between South China and the UK is only 3x. So it's just a massive difference in the equation. But back then, Victoria's Secret struggling with all these things, suppliers struggling with the behavior of these brands because they didn't understand it, right? And my job was really to bring those two things together and say, okay, let's stop talking at the suppliers and let's start being a real partner to the suppliers. Let's lock into a few great suppliers who I've now worked with my whole career. To the day I retired, I worked with fundamentally the same group of great suppliers, and really tried to treat it as a partnership. Now, I know there'll be a lot of arguments around that, but I equally have a fiduciary responsibility to the retail and brand the brands that I worked with. But as best you can, you're trying to make this a partnership that is out there. And so really tried to step back and say, what are the things that we are doing to the suppliers that is impacting us? And a great example of that is, if you're a brand and retailer who every time there's a problem simply takes the position of, well, the retailer has, the supplier has to pick that cost up, right? They're going to have to air freight the goods in, or I'm going to reject the quality and cancel the order. If you as a brand and retailer do that, that's fine. You pay for it, right? When I was supplying Victoria's Secret, I had a line that calculated the risk associated with them. And I had one for JCPenney, and I had one, and I could list them all, but I had a risk level for each person, and I built that into the cost of the goods. So they fundamentally paid for whatever they were inflicting upon me. If nothing ever happened, they overpaid. And they never understood that. They never got that side of it. But more importantly, every time they simply blamed and said, it's the supplier's fault, you know, they need to air freight the goods, what they completely lost was the opportunity to figure out what went wrong. I have a philosophy. No one woke up today to do a bad job, right? No one woke up and said, I'm going to go to work and I'm going to do a bad job today. That's my intent, right? That just doesn't happen. Something goes wrong in the process. And the simple charge it back, cancel the order, meant people were losing the chance to find out what went wrong and solve it once and for all. And so all that happens is you repeat it, you repeat it, you repeat it, and you repeat it, and you push up your costs, your waste, your quality issues, et cetera. And so I really spent a lot of time on the retail side trying to address that in every company that that I worked in, and tried to create this more balanced relationship on the recognition that it's a value chain. Everyone needs to do their bit to the best degree that they can, and everyone needs to make money in that process. And if that's not happening, then you've got a value chain that is failing you out there.
And as part of that role, my understanding from hearing you talk in the past is that you were canvassing the world, looking for promising new countries to help operations get set up in. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that process of searching for a new base of operations. What did that look like? Where were you looking? What were you looking for? And also, when did you start seriously looking at countries in Africa?
All good questions. Let me talk about the retail side for a second, because I think it's important. So one, before you start to look at the supply chain side and say, what country should I be in? What am I looking for out there? What you need is absolute clarity on where are you as a retailer and a brand going, right? What are you doing? Because that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to pair that strategy, that future vision of what my brand will look like to, therefore, what the value chain has to look like to service that most appropriately. So, so if you don't understand where the brand is going, don't even bother to look at where this the supply chain is. Just use what you've got. I think all too often people are simply chasing the next lowest cost location, and we are just so far past that today. That's just that's an irrelevant factor. It was when the price difference was 50 to 1 on labor costs. We're down to 3 or 4 to 1 in most cases now, and it's no longer irrelevant, especially with the amount of automation and that has now come to the industry. It's no longer a consideration, or it's a low consideration out there. So understand where the brand is going. And obviously, if you're a brand that intends to have a global footprint, and you know, think of every large brand in the world today, they have a global footprint. They will operate retail in over 120 countries. They'll probably have 10 primary distribution networks as they think about regions: Asia, India, subcontinent, Europe, US, Central America, South America. So they'll have these regional views. And so you're not trying to solve a single stream flow. You're now trying to solve a matrix flow, right? I need to, there's no point me moving my manufacturing to Mexico and setting it up in Mexico to serve the US if my largest growth strategy is China, Asia, rest of world, right? That's just ludicrous, right? I've got to set up something that works for that whole network that's out there. So that's the first thing to understand. You start with that, you then pair it up against what you've got, and you start to identify all the deltas that you've got. So there's a lot of pre-work has just got to be done out there. And then you start to go into free trade agreements. What are free trade agreements? What's the trend on free trade agreements? How's that stacking up all around the world? Because labor again becomes irrelevant if I'm paying 30% duty on the full value of something imported into the US, but now I can identify a country that's got a free trade agreement where it's zero. That completely, you know, labor prices pale into insignificance in that environment. So there's a lot of pre-work and a lot of inputs that you're trying to get in to address those. Which countries have you got that are headed strongly to renewable energy as opposed to a driving fossil fuel energy, right? And just taking all that into account. And also, what are the size of those countries? You know, you've got Vietnam that everybody rushed into with only 75 million people in it. And it was rapidly overwhelmed, not by the apparel industry, but rapidly overwhelmed by the electronics industry that started to put pressure on the apparel industry. And so there's a little bit of a game of chess where before you make a move, you've got to be thinking 2 to 3 to 4 years into the future, look at all the moving parts and say, then here is where I think is the right place to operate. Another factor is a term I use is that the next China is not a where, the next China is a how, right? So it's not simply about saying, well, I make this stuff in China in these types of factories, let's go to India and make it in India, or let's go to Africa and make it in Africa. You're not just thinking of, you're thinking of, but what is the future how look like? The where is less, the where is somewhat less relevant, right? But if I know what the how is, now I know what I'm looking to build in whatever location that I go to. So there's a whole sequence of steps that you've got to go through to figure it out. And then you typically will then do a reconnaissance exercise, right? Where you will visit different countries, you will meet with factories, you will meet with government officials, you will talk about and try and understand where the country strategy is going. There's no point going to a country that is committed to an electronics industry if you are trying to set up an apparel sector, because you'll just get squashed out very quickly. And again, just as a bit of background, when I was at Walmart, I didn't do apparel. I actually did electronics, toys, hardware, etc. So I did everything except food and apparel at Walmart. And it gave me a great perspective on just how those supply chains worked versus the apparel supply chain. But it also gave me a great perspective on the value of the apparel supply chains as a first mover into countries and how that amazing spillover effect comes from the apparel industry. But ultimately, you then have to weigh up the pros and cons of each country that you have got. I would, and I'll fast forward to Africa, right? What we did in Africa. So if you go all the way back to the year 2000, we actually set up an office in South Africa with a view of starting to expand manufacturing into Africa back at that time. That quickly was quickly shut down. We shut that down probably within the year, actually. Nepotism, corruption in the countries that we were going to, it was just prolific. I mean, it was bad. And I don't hold back on that fact. It was just bad and difficult at that time. And at the same time, China was opening up, WTO was coming into place in China, and it was just so much easier to stay in China, and we shut down the whole Africa work. It was really around about 2014, 2015, where my sister, who, believe it or not, who was the deputy director of trade for South Africa, she encouraged me to come back and look at Africa. She knew we'd been in Africa looking a few times, and she really encouraged us. Her view was that there was a whole new set of kind of educated ministers who were really trying to do the best. It was a whole new mindset in Africa, and that we should at least come and visit. And so we actually took a vice president, and we committed him for 1 year to go and visit different countries across Africa. And then obviously he's not spending years, he's in and out and he's checking different things. But over the course of a year, his task was, if we went into Africa, where would that be? Where would, I call it the beachhead. Where would our initial beachhead be in Africa to establish operations from which we could expand across Africa? But where is the point of entry? And we were operating in Kenya, right? So it's not like we weren't doing things in Africa, but we'd been operating in Kenya for a long time. Many companies had been operating in Kenya. So that wasn't new. It needed improved, but it wasn't new. And in fact, I had a view of Kenya was primed to move into electronics, and therefore it wouldn't necessarily be the right place for us to go. And again, these are my views, not other people's views. But in that year of learning, I think what we've learned from other countries and what translated through to Africa were a couple of things. You know, so we had mapped out who's got the most free trade agreements, happened to be Ethiopia. You had internal regional kind of working zones, EAC, East Africa Community, was very attractive. It had a positive because it was on the supply routes from Asia to Europe, to the US, at least East Coast of the US. And so it was on the supply lines, and so it could become a supply location. But I would say one of the primary factors in all of that stuff is that you needed to engage with a country that is willing to engage with you, right? You needed ministers that were passionate about helping their country build this work. And I would say Kenya was great, right? The ministers there at the time were great engaging with us all the way up to the president of the country. And the same in Ethiopia. They had a person there called Dr. Arkebi, who was just phenomenal. Every country needs a Dr. Arkebi. He was the point person with industry to go make this happen. And I think it was through our meetings with him, and it wasn't because Ethiopia kind of stood out as being the most capable. It was absolutely not. It was like China back in 1990. There were no materials, or very limited. There were no real manufacturers, very limited. There was nothing there, and it was single country landlocked, not double country landlocked, single country landlocked, where everything had to get to the sea through another country in this case. And so that creates all sorts of challenges in it. But what really stood out for us is here was a government that they themselves had a vision to build an industry that matched our vision to go build that industry out there. And that kind of really kind of stuck for us and really said, look, we could make this happen. This is going to be hard work. It's a China repeat from scratch, but we are 26 years smarter than we were when we did China. We have a lot of We have so many failures along the way from China to now that by looking at those failures and embedding them in the work that we'll do in Africa, in Ethiopia, it will make us so much better at that. And so that was really how we came about it. And we, you know, one of our biggest learnings was in that work was get everyone at the table at the beginning. So get the world's NGOs that are out there, who most of their work is what I call remedial work. They're out there trying to fix things that are already broken, that people like me broke because we were ignorant in the work that we did, and they're now trying to repair them. Instead of waiting for us to go do all this work and then in 5 years coming in and tell us we did it wrong, let's get them at the table before we even put a shovel in the ground and say, what do we do to need to get this right? Everything from what's the requirements for a factory? What's the requirements for an industrial park? What's the requirements for the town that we're going to operate close to? What's the requirement for the environment and the protection of that environment that we are going to work in? And we really did a good job, and everybody that played a part did a great job in making that happen, from the government to the manufacturers, the mills that we brought to the table, to the NGOs, the government agencies that were at the table. Everybody leaned into that. And here we are, what, now 10 years, no, 9, 8 years on in that work. And obviously Ethiopia hit some bumps along that road as we moved down that path. But I would say 8 years on, I would look back and say, there are things we would do differently if we did it again, and we'd do better if we did it again. But that was kind of how that whole thing came about. But that is very classical of how you go build it, if you're doing it properly for the long term. Still way too many people out there who are simply running around looking to place an order with someone who can offer it cheaper than the other person. And that is not a winning strategy.
From what you're saying there, then, it seems like if a government is looking to attract investment in their country, what really matters is them having their own vision and then matching that to the right company for them. That, and also, I guess you touched on a lot of things there, kind of along similar lines, having kind of talented people who are trying to make it work. Is that what you would describe as the most important thing? Are there any kind of pitches that governments would make that maybe they thought was the most effective way of positioning themselves to attract investment that actually were not really what you were interested in as a company?
Yeah, so it's not just governments, it's companies as well. So again, in the role I played, and again, maybe I was on the other side of the table in the first half of my career, but the role I played as a chief supply chain officer or head of supply chain for certain companies in certain sectors, obviously the bigger the company that you are, the more people want to come and talk to you about getting business from you, because you're talking about billions, in some cases tens of billions of dollars of business that can be allocated to that. So you're very attractive. And so there's no end of people that are willing to come and talk to you about it. The myth and kind of the what I would always try and prep them with is, don't just come and sit in front of me and tell me what your country can do, right? Or what your company can do, right? We have cotton, we have some manufacturers, we can make a t-shirt for $1.50. You know, they'll reel off all the things that historically were important, right? The in the past, those things maybe move the dial on some things. Take the time, learn what our strategy is. Can you articulate what my company's, my brand, or the brand I'm working within, the retailer I'm working within, can you articulate our strategy back? Because we typically publish that type of data. Can you articulate that clearly back to me? Can you articulate how the world of supply is changing, how the consumer environment is changing? Can you articulate the growth of the world in consumer goods and apparel, right? You're coming to talk to me in the US or in Europe. There is no growth of apparel in the US or Europe. It's in decline, right? It's going down. And yet we expect the apparel to grow from 2.2 trillion a year to 7 trillion a year, none of which, at today's currency, none of which will come from Europe or the US. It will all come from the rest of the world, China, India, Indonesia, everywhere else that's out there. But somehow you're full. So what happens is people turn up without having done all the due diligence to understand how to make a pitch, right? They've not done the work to make a pitch. And the one thing that they completely miss is, tell me how your company or your country is better than all your competitive countries out there, right? I have 50 countries I could place, I could do business in, right? There are probably 50 countries out there today that are vying strongly to win the Chinese manufacturing sector, as, you know, certainly the lower levels of that get pushed out of China, potentially Vietnam as it gets pushed out of Vietnam. India is obviously one of the biggest places that are grabbing that. But there's everybody's out there looking to kind of win business today. On it. And without getting into detail, I actually had a call yesterday with a country on specifically this. And what I kept stressing is, you can't just say, I want orders. Why are people not giving me orders, right? I'm a country, I'm ready to do business. Why don't you give me orders? What you've got to do is create a compelling reason for someone to come and place orders with you. And it can't be, what is not compelling is to say, I'm building what the world has used for the last 30 years. I'm replicating the China model. That's gone, right? That's redundant. We just haven't got past it yet. What you need to do is build the model for the future world that we are going to be operating in, right? And if you don't understand what that world looks like, then yeah, you could tell me you're at the same price or better than someone else. It's not going to move the dial for me, because price is not a dial mover for the strategic players. It is for some people, and every country will always get orders. But I think people just miss the idea that the world has changed. The supply chains that we are using today were built for the world as it was 30 years ago. And we have not yet built the supply chains as the world will look in the next 10. I only say 10 years because the world is changing far faster today than it has ever changed. So you can't think 30 years out, but at least for that next 10 years that are out there. And again, so yeah, people come and pitch to you. They just haven't done their homework. They have not done their homework across all these different elements out there. And so that when they turn up, as I say to them, when you turn up in front of me, what you present should be so overwhelmingly compelling. The only person I want to do business with, or the only place I want to do business with, is you, right? And that's not what you're doing. And so I'm probably going to hang on to what I've got. And it's a shame, because many of these places are right to do business. They've just not built the case.
And so one final question for you, which kind of you've frequently alluded to how the industry is changing and how that needs to be carefully thought about by countries vying for investment, because they need to create a pitch that matches the future of the industry rather than the past of the industry. To be fair, that is quite a hard thing for them to think about and do. So I was wondering if you could talk through kind of some of those specific ways the industry is changing. From my perspective, I guess one of the main potential drivers of that is automation, which you also alluded to. Is that such a pressing concern that it dramatically changes A, what countries should be pitching and the importance of their labor costs, but then I guess B, from the country's perspective, does that make apparel a less compelling area to target if the trends in that industry are that there will be less and less jobs available in those factories?
So I would say one of the advantages that you have in the apparel sector is it comes with some of the biggest challenges of bringing automation into place, right? So it's unlike a hard element, like a semiconductor or an automotive piece or even a piece of a barbecue, stuff that I've engaged in other places. It's much harder to manage that through automation. The apparel industry is much harder to manage these soft fabrics in that environment. And it's not to say that automation isn't coming in. It is. It absolutely is. But it is. It's more challenging, and therefore it will be somewhat slower. And there are great companies out there that are on the forefront of that. CreateMe in the US that people should look at is a company that is almost fully automated the apparel production. Amazing. But to go back to your question, every country that has not yet on that industrialization road should absolutely be looking to the apparel industry. It is a high consumer of labor. It takes people, and again, it's the challenge when you go into any new country, it takes people out of an agrarian society where you work as you are required by whatever it is you're doing. Suddenly you're in this 9-to-5 environment where, you know, you're expected to work all week, you're expected to come back next week, and it's just that repetitiveness. And that's where the labor turnover hits really hard in the first year or so as people just get used to that, but it creates that. It also helps people understand quality and what it means to do it right versus just doing it. That is something that is typically very hard for the electronics industry or other industries to bear the expense because of the level of equipment and investment they have to make is so high that trying to do that with agrarian labor could be very painful. And so hence, the apparel industry has typically always been a first mover that allows that to happen. So I would encourage any country to continue to do that. What has changed, though, is so automation for sure, but less of a factor, at least today, in the apparel industry. What has changed is the need for, first of all, globalization of brands, right? It used to be if I made for Nike or someone else, I was typically pushing stuff initially to the US because they were a US brand, and maybe later on to the US and to Europe. Today it's everywhere, right? Today that you have to figure out then what is a right supply chain solution to meet the needs of all these different countries out there. So, you know, if I make product in the US for Nike, that's great and it's incredibly fast turnover. But what about the stuff I need in China, right? How does that factory supply China? It just takes me back to scratch and I've got to do it. So what the supply chain of the future is far more networked, right? It's far more of a what we call interlace network of manufacturers that are actually working together to meet the needs of these global brands as opposed to single locations. That make those goods. You have the whole sustainability factor, right? That's almost like housekeeping now. You know, you cannot be using fossil fuels, or at least you have a view that you're phasing them out and you're working hard kind of to do that over time. All the kind of labor legislation that you have to meet, all these housekeeping things are relatively simple because they're all laid out there. All the brands have got kind of targets. All the different countries in Europe and the US have targets. So they're not hidden. So everybody should know what those are and be working in their own countries to kind of try and go solve that. And the whole kind of speed to market element that has come to bear where, you know, it's in the past, again, I go back to this in the early days where the price differential between an onshore US, Europe labor cost versus an offshore was 50x, it was 50 times cheaper offshore. And so at that time, I could afford to overproduce. And again, overproduction in apparel is the second largest form of waste in that industry. We just produce far too much that the consumer doesn't want. And then we have to mark it down to persuade them to take it or liquidate it somehow, typically with it ending up in rivers and streams in Africa and heaps of waste. But that was was never okay. But on paper, on financially, people could live with it because that price differential was so high. a price differential has gone, right? So companies that have got excess inventory are overproducing, are losing margin because they're having to discount goods heavily that would otherwise have been a dollar captured at full margin. Those companies are just finding it very painful today. And so what countries and companies have the opportunity to do is come forward and say, here is how my country or my company helps you solve these issues out there. All too often, they're looking backwards at how the world used to work and saying, I can offer you a cheaper product. Well, a cheaper product may be a few cents cheaper, and I'm losing a dollar in margin because I'm having to overproduce. And so, and to be fair, sometimes even the supply chain people or the finance people or the merchandisers within the brand, they no longer understand those equations because they grew up in an old model where the differential was 50 to 1 and have lost sight of the fact it's only a 3 to 1 differential in many countries today. And even probably in the best examples, it's maybe 10 to 1 difference out there. So dramatically different, real opportunity for companies and countries that see that forward vision. And that's where you see the rise of people like Shein, right? Or Shein out there. You see the rise of these companies, and now I can't remember who the company is, but there are, if you look at China today, almost every large global apparel brand is losing ground in China. Nike, I think, probably being the most publicized and dramatic right now, just losing big time share in China to Chinese brands that are just rising. And that's equally true in India, where you're starting to see. So you've seen all these new brands appearing around the world out there that are taking them on and can outmaneuver them because they're, Shein built a future model, not an old model. And so H&M takes a hit. Zara probably struggles a little bit. But look to the new brands, look to the new players that are arising for how that future should look. Probably less so to the legacy players that are out there. It's I hope they all change and move into the future model. But I fundamentally believe we are in what I call an extinction event right now, where just as back in the late 80s, 90s, many of the, you're probably too young, but many of the retailers that existed on the high street just don't exist anymore. And all of the manufacturers that operated in the UK, right, the big mills, the big manufacturers that were the world, probably looked at as the world's best in class capable players, they're all gone. They all disappeared. And I think we're in one of those times right now where, yeah, maybe the biggest players won't disappear, but they'll no longer be the big names, right? They'll be replaced by new players that arrive that are building the future, not trying to keep going the past.
Thanks so much, Bill. I think I could speak to you for another couple of hours because there were so many interesting threads there that we didn't even get into. But thanks again for your time today. This has been Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And we also have a Substack where we feature write-ups of the episode.